This is Stu Taylor on Business. Now, Stu Taylor.
All right, I bid you all a good day. And as I mentioned now for over a week, that today is a very, very special day. And I don't mean that in a condescending way to any of our previous guests. It's just that I have on one of America's great military historians, one of the most recognized names in the business. And his name is Victor Davis Hanson. He's a senior fellow in classics and military history at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's the award-winning author of several previous books. He's written 24 of them. And you're going to want to stick around for the whole hour. Trust me, I wouldn't have anyone on for an hour unless it was something special. The name of the book, The Second World Wars, How the First Global Conflict Was Fought and Won. And it's published by Basic Books. And Dr. Hanson has asked me to call him Victor, so I'm not just taking liberties. Victor Davis Hanson, I cannot even begin to tell you what a pleasure it is to have you on today.
Thank you for having me.
The first thing I did when I saw this book, I got very excited. Of course, it's going to take a little while to go through 600 pages. I reread this twice. I said, wait a minute, I must be missing something. The Second World Wars, How the First Global Conflict Was Fought and Won, published by Basic Books. And I reread it. It says wars as opposed to war. Give us an explanation of that, if you would.
Well, I chose a plural for two or three reasons. One is that the war extended by 1941 from the Arctic Circle in Norway to the Sahara, and then from Manchuria all the way to the Wake Islands, and from the English Channel all the way to the Volga River. So there were so many different landscapes, it was hard to connect them both strategically and politically. I don't think anybody in Bulgaria on the Axis side knew that he was on the same team, if I could use that term, with somebody in Japan fighting in Manchuria 3,000 miles away, or somebody that was in the jungles of Burma didn't have much in common with a U-boat off the coast of Miami, or a B-17 18,000 feet over Hamburg. So it was a first war, what I'm getting at, in which air and naval and land power was so diverse and so new that it was a completely sort of chaotic experience. The second was that the word World War II was not used from 1939 to 41. Germany had started, through surprise attacks, 9 separate wars and had won them all with Poland, Denmark, Norway, the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, France, Yugoslavia, and Greece, and then it had sort of isolated Britain. But people still called World War I the Great War, and people still thought that Hitler had won a series of regional wars and that the war was over, because by May of 1941, Russia was still a partner of Germany. We, the United States, were isolated and not part of the war. Britain alone was now facing, for over a year, Germany. And then suddenly, inexplicably so, in 1941, 3 events happened that changed these border wars into a global war and earned the name World War II, and then World War I came into use instead of the Great War. And one was, of course, the surprise attack on the Soviet Union, a partner of Hitler's, on June 22nd, 1941, the surprise attack of the Japanese, not just on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, but on December 8th on Singapore and Malaya, that brought Britain into a war with Japan. And then the most inexplicable, maybe, was the declaration of war of Italy and Germany on the United States on December 11th. At that point, there was a new alliance of the Soviet Union, the United States, and Britain against the 3 Axis powers that now included Japan. And then, to be frank, it was called World War II, but it was also a war suddenly that the Axis could not win, because they had changed the calculus and they were now fighting an alliance that had over 400 million people against their 170, and had a prior GDP before the war that was about 7 times larger than the combined Axis. And indeed, the United States by 1945 would have a larger GDP than Russia, Italy, Japan, Germany, Britain, together, larger than all the other belligerents together. So those decisions that were made by Hitler, Tojo, and Mussolini, I think you could say, doomed them in 1941. And then the question in 1942 and 3 and 4 was, would the United States and the new alliance demand unconditional surrender or just a World War I like armistice?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
That was very difficult to achieve.
I just want to say that you're talking about the differences in the war, but really wasn't this almost, in a sense, predetermined? Because this war was miscalculated by Japan and Germany, in the sense that it was, I think, more ideological or cultural driven. And the reality of war was that it was becoming more pragmatic, just in not in the matter of numbers, but in a matter of superior technology and strategy.
Yeah, I think that's true. Germany and Italy and Japan lived in more in a realm of ideological fantasy, fascist fantasy. And the United States, the way it chose weapons, the strategies that it selected, the industrial policy that it enacted, they were all very pragmatic. Whereas, and I'll give you one example of what I mean. If you want to deliver explosive over a target, it was about 100 times cheaper per pound to do it with a B-24 or B-17 than a V-1 or V-2 rocket. And yet Hitler insisted on the V-1 program and the V-2 program that had about as much damage over 2 years as a single B-17 raid. And yet the Japanese, to give you another example, built the two largest battleships in the world together. Over 4 years, they only sunk one escort carrier. Had they used the same labor and capital, they could have built 50 destroyers, which they had the best destroyers in the world, and it would have been a much wiser investment. So they were autocratic societies in which decision-making was not transparent. It was not audited. There was no press that contributed. Stalin was like them, but he fortunately had two constitutional states that were his allies that coordinated with him. But I think what I'm saying is that, as a historian, in their defense, if I could defend the Axis, I don't mean it ethically, is that at the time, Germany said to itself, we knocked out Russia in World War I, but we couldn't knock out France. In World War II, we knocked France out in 6 weeks. Therefore, by the World War I ratio, we'll knock out Russia in 3 weeks, not thinking that Tsarist Russia was comparable to Communist Russia. And then Hitler said to himself, they didn't do well in Finland. They didn't do well when we divided Poland up with them. They didn't do well when they backed the Loyalists in the Spanish Civil War. Therefore, I can go into the Soviet Union in 3 weeks and take it, and I haven't lost yet. That was his thinking. And Japan said to itself, the United States did not stop us from going into Southeast Asia and taking over Vichy France colonial possessions. They did not stop us in China. They let their ally, London, burn during the Blitz. They won't do much, if anything, and they have the 17th largest army in the world behind Portugal in 1941. What they didn't know was, and this is, I think, your point, that even before the grand mobilization, there were 27 Essex carriers on order. There was another 11 battleships. There was 200 submarines. And so the fleet that Japan attacked at Pearl Harbor was about the same size in the Pacific, but with its Atlantic fleet was bigger than Japan's. But we had ordered a fleet that was five times larger than the existing one that was either under construction or already built, literally, and it would be deployed within 2 years, and it would be a fleet larger than all the fleets in the world put together. That's kind of an astonishing achievement.
Well, we're going to come up on a break here in just a minute, but I do want to get into the question on a follow-up of Russia's confrontation with Germany, and it was devastating for Russia. We can go into that later. Was Stalin forced into war?
Not at all. Stalin's critical mistake is that he believed that National Socialism and Soviet Communism had something in common, and that he wanted the Western democracies destroyed. He thought that it would be like World War I. So when he colluded with the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of August 23rd, 1939, And that essentially sent Hitler into Poland, but more importantly, guaranteed him that Stalin would not attack him from his...
All right, we're gonna take a break. We're going to, unfortunately, I wish we could do this break-free. Victor Davis Hanson, The Second World Wars. You've got to get this book. I mean, it's amazing. He'll be rejoining us after a break. All right, we're back, so we'll cut that sound down. You usually like to kind of sit here, close my eyes, and listen, but not this morning. We're going to just do real quick in cues for that. Rejoining us, I'm happy to say, for the entire hour, I've really been looking forward to this, is Victor Davis Hanson. The book, The Second World Wars, How the First Global Conflict Was Fought and Won. It's published in a hardcover by Basic Books. It's about 600 pages, but it's not the quantity. It's the quality of this book that has given me such an understanding of World War II that, honestly, that I've never had up until now. And I think it's part of our history, which seems to be being drowned out by the far left in this country, that you should not ignore. Victor, as we come back here, was there a way for the Axis powers to have won this war and they blew it? Was it? Did it come down to more strategy and tactical moves as opposed to ideology and the weaponry?
Well, if just two events had not happened after 1941, I don't think they could have won. But had Hitler not gone into the Soviet Union, he would have had the present territory that's in the European Union under his control. And I don't think we could have landed there in Normandy without the Soviet Union killing 3 million German soldiers, which they did by 1944. And then the other question is, why did Japan attack Pearl Harbor? There was no Netherlands. It had ceased to exist in 1940, as did an independent France. And all Japan had to do was get the agricultural Southeast Asia area, which it did, and then take over what is now Indonesia, the Shell oil fields in the Dutch East Indies, and maybe take Britain's Malaysia, which it did, for rubber. But had it just sidestepped the Philippines, the United States, I don't think we would have declared war on it.
And then the admiral threatened to resign if they did not do it, and wasn't that, I mean, immediately the biggest mistake of the war, because he didn't have an exit strategy.
Yeah, I try to look at so-called icons in a different way in the book. And Admiral Yamamoto, I think, was a very poor commander and a terrible strategist. He was the force. Everybody feels that he was sort of an intellectual or cosmopolitan because he'd come to the United States in the 20s. He hated the United States. He felt it was decadent. He used his experience here to convince people that we were weak. And he's the one that insisted on the Pearl Harbor attack, which was an utter disaster. When you get in an existential war, the question is, can you hurt the industrial base of your enemy? And yet the Axis caused these existential wars, and they had no four-engine bomber. They had no way to bomb Russia beyond the Urals or the United States. Germany didn't have an aircraft carrier, either did Italy. Japan had no fuel or air cover to get all the way over to San Diego, much less to get to Detroit. So they started a war in 1940, at the end of 41, in which if the Allies mobilized, they were able to put into the field about 30 million soldiers. And as I said before, we built 7,000 ships. It was just a question of, were we going to say, cry uncle, or we were going to go to Rome, Berlin, and Tokyo and force them to surrender under our terms? That was going to be much more difficult. They had 20 million soldiers at one time mobilized, the three Axis powers. But we did it within 3 years, so it was a remarkable achievement.
Some things, they just don't come to an average person's conscious level. You know, when you hear something and you say, why didn't I think of that? It's so obvious. But some of the differences are in this war as opposed to others were rather profound. Number one, and you talk about it in the book, this isn't my attempt to educate anyone out there, the difference between the Civil War and World War One, as opposed to World War Two. You say they were one-dimensional, but there's another reason. I might as well put that in here as well. This went beyond the bounds of a border wall, and it's the first time, as a matter of fact, it went beyond the borders of countries. And that, in a sense, defines really the essence of this book, that it became a multidimensional, multi-component war, and completely different than the Civil War and World War One.
And you can see it by the nature of the casualties. It's the first major war in which there were more civilians, far more. About 80% of the deaths were civilians. And in addition to that, the winners lost about 80% of the cat. That's very rare in a war. If you wanted to reduce the war down to the dead, it was largely a story of German and Japanese soldiers butchering those without arms and who were not in uniform. In China, 16 million. In Russia, about 15 million civilians. And then in Eastern Europe, about 8 million. And we forget that sometimes, that the Japanese and German soldiers were pretty much savage killers, and most of their killing took place against those who couldn't fight back.
Yeah, the numbers are extraordinary. They're unimaginable. Of course, you could look to Stalin and Mao in terms of real butchery, but I mean, how do you distinguish between that and this? All of those people needlessly killed many more civilians, and you make a note of the fact, and it's that this is the most lethal war in any 6-year period in history. And could you talk about that from the standpoint of our weaponry and the technology advantages that we had? When the Germans had something, we immediately went into action by building our own resources, capital, human and capital resources.
Yeah, 27,000 people died every day of the 6 years. And the war started with biplanes and it ended with jets. It started with Lee Enfield bolt-action rifles that could shoot with a magazine about 7 to 10 shots a minute, and it ended up with a Sturmwasser assault weapon that could shoot at a rate of 1,200 shots per minute. We started out with 100-pound bombs. We ended up with 1,000 pounds of napalm, which the U.S. developed, one of the most lethal incendiary agents that's ever been developed. And whether we looked at tanks, they started out at 8 tons with an inch of armor. They ended up, in the case of the Tiger II, 70 tons with 7 inches of armor. The barrel went from about 20 millimeters to 88 millimeters. So in every category of weaponry, a aircraft carrier that might have been 30,000 ended up 40,000. 16-inch battleship barrel went up to 18 inches. And we started out with a B-17 that could go about 800 miles in either direction. We ended up with a B-29 that could go 1,600. So there was an element of acceleration in technology and industrial output in just that 6 years that nobody could quite fathom. It took us usually about 9 years to design an aircraft and then put it into the field, and yet the P-51 Mustang was designed, and with them, the British put the engine in it, and it was flying within about 13 months. It was the best aircraft, fighter aircraft of the entire war. I think that's a reminder that when people get up in the morning at 5 in the morning and they work at a breakneck rate and they go to bed at 9 and they work 7 days a week and people stay at their draft table or businessmen stay at their desk all weekend, then the collective labor and the frenzy do things that just don't otherwise make
All right, we're going to take another break. We're going to come back with Victor Davis Hanson for the remainder of the show. The Second World War is how the first global... All right, we are back with Victor Davis Hanson. I recommend this book to everyone. I mean, I don't care what your political persuasion is, and we have such a polarized society right now that I've never seen the likes of before. This book has nothing to do with it. This is history. It's based in fact, and it is so beautifully written. And the one thing about Victor David Hanson Victor Davis Hanson that I appreciate more than anything is, look, everything he writes, I understand, and that's a rarity for me. He's taken things from an intellectual level and put it on a level that we can all comprehend, since my IQ is under 70. The name of the book is The Second World War's How the First Global Conflict was fought and won, and it's published by Basic Books. Do not miss this read. Victor, an interesting thing here, and this may be just a sideline of the book, but you know, we were all thrilled, and we'd sometimes have the tendency, having asked George Bush, asked Barack Obama, to overestimate the results of a perceived victory. And this one, it may be the case too, although its shape and form is different. What you mentioned in the book about the eradication of Nazism and fascism after the wars. What's your take on what's going on today? I mean, it's really rather frightening. Only it's not military or violent in nature, but the ultimate consequences may lead to that, as we may be involved in a civil war in this country.
Yes, I think our generation that won World War II had an idea that they didn't have to be perfect to be good, so they went to war to eradicate fascism. That's what they thought. And when they ended the war, they had succeeded in many of those goals. I mean, there was a humane government in Japan within 5 years, Italy within 5 years, Germany was cut in four, then eventually into two, and Nazism was gone. But as George Patton said right when the war ended, we tried to free Eastern Europe from totalitarianism, and we ensured it because it was sort of like Tolkien's ring and the Lord of the Rings. Once you use the Soviet Union, you were sort of stuck, and they killed two out of three German soldiers, but the result was they were all the way now to the German border. They controlled the Baltic states, and that generation then, in its can-do attitude, just said, okay, now we've got an ally that turned to an enemy. And the Soviet Union had a much easier propaganda. They told the world they were still fighting World War II. They were liberating people in China and Burma and Southeast Asia from British imperialism, American imperialism, and the Allies, that is us and the British, had sold out and joined the Axis. They were helping the Japanese now. They were helping the Germans. And for a lot of people who were not aware, that was a powerful ideology all during the late 40s and 50s. But in their defense, they did create deterrence. They corralled China and Russia. They created, out of World War II, what we, and you know that better than I do as a student of finance, the post-war order, international commerce, communications, travel. And so the world between 1945 and the present was largely the work of that Western alliance of diplomats. And its basic idea was Germany down, Russia out, the U.S. in. But now it's been 75 years since the key year, 1942 at least, and things have changed. And so the United States is now saying to itself, what are the lessons of World War II that will prevent another global war under this new regime in China and North Korea as well as Iran? I think the lesson is military preparedness cannot cease when you're in a period of supposed peace, and that deterrence, the ability to convince an aggressor not to try something stupid, depends not only on your fleet and your aircraft, but your willingness or your spiritual impression that you're capable of using it. Unfortunately, Britain and France had a bigger army than Germany did in 1940, but Hitler invaded France because he was convinced after 6 years of appeasement that they wouldn't fight as well as the Wehrmacht, and that we in the United States wouldn't help them, and that Russia would indeed look the other way or actively help. And all that was true, and so the larger army lost. And I think the problem I'm worried about North Korea is I don't think they understand fully how powerful the United States is. And I don't think China knows that either, because for about 25 years we've appeased the North Koreans to such a degree that they feel that, well, the United States may have that power, it may not, but it doesn't matter because they're so scared of us that they would never do anything, and they might do something stupid. So we have to reestablish deterrence in a very careful, sober way. Deterrence, as Lord Halifax the First said, he said in 17th century, we hang horse thieves not because somebody stole a horse, but because people don't go out and steal horses. And that's the idea behind it. Iran is watching North Korea. China deliberately set this rogue nation upon us. And if we don't deal with it in a way, we're going to have a war. And I think World War II reminds us that it's not a bad word or a sloppy expression that causes a war. It's usually a perception that a powerful country will not or cannot do anything to protect its interests.
Well, if I had to choose one buzzword to use during this conversation, and you, it's almost like you anticipated what my next question was. It's appeasement. You can go all the way. You can go just as short back to I think the worst president in American history, and that's Barack Hussein Obama. Appeasement, apology, and that demonstrates weakness. And people can say anything they want about Donald Trump. He is promoting an air of strength that I believe is having a really positive effect. Appeasement has been very destructive for us, and you have to show you're superior to the other person. Now, I don't mean in terms of character or birthrights, but superior in terms of power, and that's the greatest deterrent. I don't want to get through this interview without having you touch upon a great ally all these years, and that's Great Britain. They are part of the war, the first one in. In a sense, the last one out, and the genius of Winston Churchill.
Yeah, one of the things I wrote the book was to remind Americans how much we owe Great Britain. It was the only country of the Allies that alone fought Germany for a year, from the fall of France in June of 1940 to the entry of the Soviet Union in June of 1941. It was the only country of all the major belligerents on either side that fought the first day of the war, September 2nd, 1939, to the end, September 2nd, 1945. It was the only country that went to war without having been attacked itself or without attacking another country. It went to war on the principle of trying to help Poland. And then all during the Blitz, to take one example, Supermarine Spitfire production, we don't appreciate that, exceeded BF-109 German aircraft. And when the war was over, the British Empire alone produced more trucks, more tanks and more planes than did the Third Reich. That's aside from the United States and Soviet Union. And it gave us some of the best weapons in the world, from sonar to the Merlin engine, which was a superb aircraft engine that we used a lot. When we had a Sherman tank that was not as good as the Panther tank, the British said, let's put one of our 17-pound barrels in it, and then it turned out to be a Tiger tank killer. So there was a level of states, and then that's not even touching upon Churchill's statesmanship. If Churchill had not been prime minister when France was attacked on May 10th, I think that 6 weeks later, the British government would have collapsed and Hitler would have cut a deal with Britain, and the Nazi regime would have been from the English Channel, as I said, all the way to the Russian border.
The book, again, I can't say it enough, and I'll continue to promote it over the next week. Victor Davis Hanson, The Second World Wars, and that's plural, How the First Global Conflict Was Fought and Won. It's published by Basic Books, and I'll be finishing that book this weekend. Very hard for me to sit down and do things like this, but in this case, this is truly an exception. Can't stop reading it. Have to stop reading it to eat and sleep and do all those other things. It's a marvelous book. We're heading up on a break here, and it may be a poor timing. So I will. I'll ask this quickly, and then you can finish it after the break. All right, and that's Italy, and why the punitive measures against Italy and Italy's general overall suffering came nowhere near the scope of that of Japan and Germany, and yet they were certainly instrumental in creating all this damage and havoc. And as a matter of fact, now that I've asked the question, we're so close to a break, I may have to interrupt you after three words.
Okay.
So let's save that one till after a break, and we'll continue here with the remainder of the hour with, in my estimation, one of America's great writers, military strategists, and you don't often get the pleasure of having Victor Davis Hanson to speak, and I'm just delighted and thankful. All right, let's take that break. All right, we're back. You know, there are so many days where things go by, and you wish they'd go by faster, and then there are days like today where the pleasure is so great. I wish I had Victor Davis Hanson to talk with all day. The book, a masterpiece. It's a masterpiece. And if you think it's just me, go check it out. It's The Second World Wars, How the First Global Conflict Was Fought and Won. It's published by Basic Books, and this goes right in my personal bookshelf. And that I can tell you, having done thousands of interviews, I don't put a lot in there. Victor, as we continue here, and after the praise I said I wouldn't give you, Italy, we're going to talk about the role of Italy and why the punitive measures weren't as great. You almost get a feeling of, gee, you know, I've always loved Italy. And yet the treachery that's come out of there, you know, you look at Mussolini and you look at that, somehow it seems to be suppressed, doesn't it?
Yes, I think it does. Italy had a strange relationship in World War II because it had been an ally in World War I. It had lost 500,000 soldiers fighting the Austrians on the side of the Allies. And then under Mussolini, it was fascist, but it never had the racial hatred and Holocaust that Germany enacted or that Japan did in China. It did a little bit in the Somaliland, but Mussolini's entire agenda was to build a big fleet and let Germany knock out France. There would be no more French fleet in the Mediterranean. It would control Libya and Tunisia, and then it would have Dalmatia and Greece, and would have a new Roman Empire in the Mediterranean. That was his entire goal. But the problem was that Hitler did not get rid of the British fleet, and the United States came into the war because of Italy when it declared war on us. And then they had no control over the Mediterranean. They were the first of the Axis to get knocked out of the war. And then they had a very bloody fight in Italy. It was fought over longer than was Russia or Germany. And we never invaded Japan. So when the war was over, there was a large Italian-American community. There was the Vatican. There was a large reservoir of goodwill. And yet Italy was the only country that voluntarily or at least attempted to get rid of Mussolini on its own. So there was a lot of goodwill toward Italy. And we said, you know, we fought over from Sicily all the way up to Milan. Italians fought Italians. Germans fought Italians. Americans fought Italians. We kept the Russians out, so they were never had any say in Italy. And the result of all that was we didn't put a lot of Italian officers on trial like we did Germans. We had a pretty mild occupation. We didn't divide the country into four sections. The Russians had no say in the way they did in Austria and Eastern Europe and Britain. And Italy basically left. The fascist government was gone by early 1944. There were some remnants in the north, but it was dysfunctional. And we, the last year, fought more with Italians on our side than against us. And I'm just adding all that to show you why they didn't really suffer after the war, at least by in terms of occupation and carpet bombing the way that Japan and Germany had.
As we close, come down to our closing minutes here, and I think about my own personal life. I'm a conservative. I have some libertarian in me. I'm a populist. I'm a nationalist. And it makes common sense if, you know, as situations around the world change, you change. For example, I've never really loved Rand Paul for his views on Israel, for his isolationism. And even though I don't advocate total isolationism, I do certainly advocate not giving out this huge money all around the world to people who need it, but you've got to take care of 310 million people here first. As we look at the position that we have here, why and how did we suddenly assume the responsibility of taking care of the rest of the world? And I know I don't sound compassionate, but it's real, and obviously more people feel the way I do than don't. We're fed up.
Well, I think it was for two reasons. One is that Britain would have lost World War II had we not intervened. Even Russia would have lost. We supplied Russia with 20% of its needs. And then after the war was over, Russia had 700 divisions, the Soviet Union did. There was no other power that had the clout to contain Russia and China, and we did. And after that, I think the world, especially Western Europe, the NATO members, became complacent, and they thought, you know what, the United States defeated fascism, then they defeated global communism. It's their duty just to deal with radical Islam, to deal with any Chinese expansionism, especially in Western Europe, in the Western world. And I think now people are saying, wait a minute, as you say, we have about 310, 320 million people. We only have 6% of the world's population, and we have industrial wastelands in the Midwest due to some of the excesses and cheating and globalization, and we're not going to do it anymore. And that's causing our bi-coastal elite a great shock, because usually the consequences of their own ideology don't affect them personally, whether it's unchecked illegal immigration or it's Chinese cheating on trade. And so they've given a view that's sort of out of date, and there's a lot of Americans that say, wait a minute, people swarmed in my school, they don't speak English, they're here illegally, this affects me, or this plant was a good plant, we followed copyright, patent, trade laws, and yet we've shut down because of globalization. So it doesn't mean we can't be global, we have to continue to be competitive and global and have free trade, but I think we're in a period of saying, we've done this now since the end of World War II, and we're not going to continue to do it. We're going to do things that are more directly in our perceived interest than to be globalist and cosmopolitan and internationalist, which is usually resented by people who are the actual beneficiaries of our help.
We've got less than a minute, so here's a tough question for you. Is there anything you'd like to say about the remaining 20 seconds here that we haven't covered?
I just think that I have a great deal of gratitude for the generation in America that fought World War II. 12.5 million people in uniform fought in the air, sea, and land. And they proved to the Japanese and the Germans that, wow, they could not produce industrial goods and weapons like we could. The 1st Marine Division or the U.S. 1st Armored Division could fight as well as Germans or Japanese that had this reputation for invincibility. So I really think when we look at the Depression and World War II and that generation that's now 80s and 90s, I'm afraid to say that my own, and I'm 64, we just haven't been able to emulate their courage or their ability. When I look at the NFL or I look at...
Oh, goodness. We're going to have to do that on a separate show. Victor Davis Hanson, the Second World Wars. Thank you so much for a fabulous hour. It's been great having you on. Please, please come back. This is Stu Taylor. We'll see you back here tomorrow. You started your